Mr. Regan was an athlete. He was a radio announcer. Then he got into show business, and now he has some other interests. Sometimes on Sunday night, our little boy that's 5 and a half will say when the General Electric hour comes on, "Daddy, here comes Mr. Progress." So I want to introduce Mr. Progress, Ronald Regan.
Thank you very much. That was certainly kinder than General Electric. But, you know, it's no secret to us in my business that it was only a generation ago that the people of our profession couldn't even be buried in the churchyard. Of course, the world has improved since then. We can be buried now. As a matter of fact, the eagerness of some of you to perform that service gets a little frightening at times. But, naturally, anyone in this position, any actor worth his salt, is very desirous of saying the right thing, finding the appropriate remarks to make. I know there was a young fellow in our business that studied voice. He aspired to an operatic career, and he concluded his studies in Milan, Italy. And upon the conclusion of his studies, he achieved that greatest of all triumphs for an opera singer. He was invited to sing at La Scala, the very spiritual fountainhead of opera. They did Pagliacci, and that night as he sang the beautiful aria Vesti la Giubba, concluded suddenly from the balconies and the galleries and the orchestra seats, the applause burst on the stage and was so thunderous and so sustained that the opera couldn't continue until he stepped back and repeated the aria. And again, the same sustained thunderous applause, and again he sang Vesti la Giubba. And this went on until finally he motioned for quiet. And he said, "Ladies and gentlemen," and he tried to tell them how full his heart was, what this reception had meant to him. But he said, "I have sung Vesti la Giubba 9 times. My voice is gone. I cannot sing it again." And a voice from the balcony says, "You will do it till you get it right." Of course, I don't want you to think now, don't get alarmed and think that in an effort to say things right, I'll stay here for 9 encores and keep you in this room all afternoon. I once learned the importance of brevity in a speech. I was making a talk, and in the audience was a friend of mine, the minister of the First Christian Church of Oklahoma City, Bill Alexander. He's a big, rough, red-headed fella, doesn't look at all like your picture version of a minister. But when I'd finished talking, Bill told me about his first experience as a preacher. And I've always felt there was some connection between his story and my speech. He told me that he had worked for 6 weeks on his first sermon, wanted to make a very good impression, and arrived to speak at an evening service in a little country church in Oklahoma. Stood up in the pulpit and looked out at a church that was empty, except for one lone little man. So Bill went down and he said, "My friend, you seem to be the only member of the congregation that showed up. What do you think? I'm just a young preacher getting started. Should I go through with it?" And the fella said, "Well, I wouldn't know about that sort of thing, but I do know this. If I loaded up a truckload of hay, took it out in the prairie, and only one cow showed up, I'd feed her." Well, Bill figured this was a cue, so he got back up in the pulpit, and an hour and a half later said, "Amen." And he went down and he said, "My friend, like I told you, I'm just a young preacher getting started. What did you think?" And he says, "Well, like I told you, I'm a little old cowpoke. I don't know about that sort of thing, but I do know this. If I loaded up a truckload of hay, took it out in the prairie, and only one cow showed up, I sure as hell wouldn't give her the whole load." But you know, any speaker at any kind of an affair always tries to establish some relationship between himself and the audience, some reason for his being there. I think it's pretty apparent that there are certain critics of a hostile nature, to my business at least, who would say that there is probably a similarity in product that would make my being here easily justified. It's probably presumptuous of anyone to think that he could stand up here and talk about Hollywood or the motion picture industry and find anything to say that would be of news to anyone in America or the world. It is true that the motion picture industry is covered by more actual news coverage than is given to any spot on earth except Washington, D.C. There are 450 full-time correspondents assigned to report the doings of the picture people 24 hours a day. And these 450 correspondents have a total combined circulation of over 2.5 billion. In spite of this, I would never dare hint because of it, certain misconceptions still do exist about our people and our business. As a matter of fact, we were amazed to find out some time ago, we did a little survey, found that the average opinion, the most widespread opinion that our fellow citizens have of us, is that anyone connected with the making of pictures is crazy. Second in widespread belief, we are immoral to the point of degeneracy. We live in a state of legalized prostitution, flitting from one husband or wife to the other with little regard for the moral and social code. We're thoroughly reprehensible people, and if we have any civic consciousness at all, we join the Communist Party. Well, now some of us had suspected this was true of our neighbors. We knew it wasn't true of ourselves, so we did a little further research, and we were amazed to find out the extent of the misconceptions even about our neighbors. There are 26,000 of us in the picture business. We represent 1% of the population of Los Angeles, and annually we contribute 12% of all that's given in this community to charity. 70% of our people are married, more than 70% of those to their first husband or wife. 69% of those have children. We lead the nation in the adoption of children. We lead the nation in proportionate numbers in church membership and attendance. We have the lowest crime rate of any industrial or professional group in the world, not even excluding the clergy. And we were, however, disappointed to learn that in that most highly publicized facet of our existence, the Hollywood divorce rate, it is true that 29.9% of our marriages in the motion picture industry will end up in the divorce court. We were even sorrier to learn that the national average is 40%, and we eagerly look forward to the day when you'll catch up with our high moral standards. Now, as a business, ours is a first-generation business. Ours is a business in which, for the most part, the men who run our studios today are the same men who started this business. Started it from the most humble of beginnings, back in their youth when they took small tin cans of film, nothing but a novelty, a picture that moved on the wall. This was the only selling point they had, and these pictures were nicknamed chasers, so-called because they used them in the vaudeville theaters to chase an audience out at the end of a show and get a turnover and get a new audience in for the second show. And from that humble beginning, these men in their single lifetime have built an industry that today represents a capital investment in America of better than $3 billion, gives employment throughout the country to more than 500,000 people, exclusive of the editorial staff of Confidential Magazine. And in their lifetime, they have captured more than two-thirds of the playing time of all the screens of the world for the Hollywood-made product. And they've done this in spite of the fact that here is the only country in the world where the pictures of all the world are free to play with no restriction on playing time, no limitation as to the number of films that can be imported, and no restriction tax-wise or on profits as to whether they can take their money home with them or not. In almost every country of the world, our films play under those restrictions. And in the negotiations leading to those arrangements, on our side of the table have sat private American businessmen, and on the other side of the table have sat representatives of the foreign governments. And when finally they have determined what portion of our profit we can bring back to this country, we are then told by law in those countries that we must take a portion of that profit and plow it back into their industry as a subsidy so that it can be built up and come out on the world market and attempt to take our business away from us. In all of these negotiations, we have never once asked for government on our side of the table, because we have a sneaking suspicion in Hollywood that when you ask the government for help, you wind up with a partner. Now, in spite of this, we're pretty proud of our patriotic record. Ours is an industry that during World War II didn't do business on a cost or cost-plus basis. We gave away the only thing we had to sell. We furnished our product free to the armed forces, and we went a step beyond that. At our own expense, the motion picture industry printed up $42 million worth of 16-millimeter prints and gave them outright to the armed forces for use overseas. We asked for no deferment of our essential personnel, and more than 25% of our manpower was in the armed forces. And I think any serviceman can tell you the record of the rest, the so-called glamour gals and guys who weren't in uniform but who were sent all over the world by way of USO to bring a touch of home, a song and dance to our overseas personnel. What a strange paradox then with this record, that in the last 10 years of unprecedented prosperity in America, when the motion picture industry has been suffering great economic distress, that the blows causing that distress were struck by our own government. In the 30 years following World War I, the motion picture industry had a pattern of vertical structure. Several large companies controlled the product from raw material to consumer. They had large studios that were fully staffed and manned by technicians and craftsmen and workers. They had large contract lists of artists, actors, directors, writers, and producers. They owned worldwide distribution systems, and they each owned chains of several hundred theaters throughout the world. This economic structure, vertical structure, gave us a stability that carried us through two world wars and the Great Depression. It is a stability we no longer enjoy. In 1948, the Supreme Court handed down a ruling in the antitrust action that had been brought against the industry, divorced the ownership of studios and theaters, and did away with our economic sales system known as block booking. This was called by one antitrust authority in Washington the greatest experiment by government in the vertical disintegration of an industry in the history of the Sherman Act. And what has been the result of that experiment? Well, in the 10 years since 1948, employment in Hollywood has dropped to 43% of its 1948 level. Our wage scale, once one of the highest, is now one of the lowest in Los Angeles County. When they eliminated block booking, which is nothing more nor less than taking advance orders for motion picture films to be made so that we can plan our production a year ahead, they have brought about a condition in which the entire industry is freelance. 26,000 workers today, no longer on a regular employed basis, no contract system in Hollywood. Each worker, each artist, goes to work when he gets a chance on a picture and then is unemployed until he gets another call from a producer to go to work on another picture. We not only cannot plan our production a year ahead, there isn't a studio in Hollywood that can tell you what its production schedule is for next month. When Cecil B. DeMille invested $13 million to make the Ten Commandments, he did so knowing that he could not take an advance order for his film before it was finished, and that when it was completed, if no theater bought his film, he was prohibited by law from even renting a theater and running his own film in an attempt to get some of his money back. Now, we fought back, of course, in this antitrust action, but we weren't very used to fighting. Ours was an industry in which we operated on the Barnum philosophy. Our whole idea was, well, when the attacks were made, when the misconceptions grew up about us, well, don't look, it'll go away. We, in short, allowed ourselves to become village idiots on the industrial scene. We paid no heed to our business climate. And when you do this, you automatically fall prey to government interference and harassment at every level, and its twin evil, discriminatory taxation. In that latter field, I could make an entire address on the manner in which the income tax affects the people of our business. Let me just briefly say that in our own people, among our own people, the actors, it's standard procedure in this freelance business for an actor, even of a six-figure income, to go from that six-figure income at a 91% tax bracket to as much as 2 years complete unemployment. This is standard. The average earning period for an actor in motion pictures is only 5.5 years. There is no recognition for either one of these peculiarities in all the thousands of tax volumes. As a matter of fact, there are only two mentions of actors in all of the thousands of volumes on taxes. One mention says that actors cannot be considered as businessmen because they're professionals. And under professionals, it says we can't be considered professionals because when we work, we get a salary instead of a fee. Now, in the field of taxes, four times the Screen Actors Guild has gone to Washington, D.C. to lobby or to protest treaties, reciprocal tax treaties ratified by the United States Senate, protecting the citizens of other countries and our own citizens from the penalties of dual taxation when working in one or the other country. We've gone to Washington because in each of these instances, the treaty was ratified containing a clause that said the protection of this treaty extends to all citizens of this country except actors. In the field of government interference, I've mentioned the antitrust action. I could point to an almost unbroken record over the last 10 or 15 years of some form of antitrust and anti-monopoly action brought against the picture business every year. I could point to a record of government investigation by governmental or congressional committees almost every election year. Sometimes their efforts reach our best comedy efforts. A few years ago, a Western senator introduced a bill in Congress which would have established a permanent congressional committee. This committee would pass on actors and actresses on the basis of their morals, and anyone who couldn't pass the congressional committee's test would be denied a license and therefore would be unable to work in pictures. We thought that one was pretty funny at the time because there were two United States senators in prison and no actors. But sometimes it gets very serious. A few weeks ago, you probably didn't notice the little item in the paper, a statement made by the owners of the motion picture industry, who stated that they had yielded after almost a year's resistance. They had yielded to intolerable pressure, and against their better judgment were giving in to the demands of our own State Department to make available for showing behind the Iron Curtain American motion pictures in exchange for the showing on our screens of Russian motion pictures. This was part of the cultural exchange program. We didn't protest because we fear how you will react when you see a Russian motion picture, because we're pretty sure that the American public can determine what is and is not propaganda. But we know that once our films leave our control and go behind the Iron Curtain, those films can be re-edited, they can be distorted, they can be redubbed into a foreign language, and the entire meaning of our films can be changed in order to make them anti-American propaganda. But even more serious than this in the field of government interference is the field of political censorship. Here is this great segment of the communications industry, the motion picture industry, with its own voluntary production code, in which more than 500 producers have agreed that they will attempt to control vulgarity and obscenity and poor taste on the screen by voluntarily subscribing to this code. In spite of this, there is political censorship by law. I'm not speaking of the various groups and organizations in our land. I'm speaking of legal censorship in more than 11 states and over 200 cities, and it grows every day. We in Hollywood have a feeling that you can't limit this kind of censorship to just one segment of the communications industry without having it spread. Nor do we believe it's just a restriction on us. We think that more properly it's a case of a few of your neighbors deciding they will tell you what you're qualified to see and hear in a motion picture screen. And with regard to limiting this just to the motion picture industry, well, in the last session of Congress, no less than 5 bills were introduced, bills which would have put non-defense departments and bureaus of the government under the security provisions and would have made it a felony to report the doings of these various bureaus and departments of the government. Indeed, when the civil rights legislation was passed, in spite of the hotly contested issue and the debate pro and con, that bill became a law containing a clause that was never debated, that says that if any reporter reports the doings of the Civil Rights Commission without that commission's consent, he is liable to 5 years imprisonment. We believe, too, that when censorship of this kind is political, it gets away from the control of vulgarity and obscenity and gets into the very dangerous area of thought control. In Memphis, Tennessee, an elderly man, as the local censor there for 30 years, has kept the people from seeing Mr. DeMille's Bible epic, The King of Kings, because he says he disagrees with Mr. DeMille's interpretation of the Bible. We in Hollywood are as concerned as you that your children and ours should not be subjected to vulgarity and obscenity on a motion picture screen. But we're even more concerned that whole generations of American kids are growing up, taking it for granted that someone in this country can tell them what they can see and hear on a motion picture screen. Because we believe them, they're mentally conditioned when they take our place someday to accept that someone can tell them what they can read and what they can hear from a speaking platform and what they can think and what they can say. And if you think I'm viewing too much with alarm, I would like to quote to you some figures from a recent survey that was made of the American teenager, a great survey in depth of thousands of teenagers of high school age. And they found that 61% of the American teenagers today believe that the government should have control, censorship control of press, radio, and television. 56% of them believed the government could cure our economic ills by taking from the rich and giving to the poor. And 25% of the boys and 33% of the girls believed the government should own and operate outright the basic industries such as steel and mining and the railroads. And in answer to a question as to who was most responsible for our high standards of living, government, labor leaders, or business came off a poor third. And the seniors interviewed were almost unanimous in their statement that business basically had been bad for America. And suddenly, with a chill down your spine, you realize that freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. Now, once upon a time, I could have cited these various things as just the protest of someone relegated by profession to a second-class citizenship. Today, you could answer back, probably from your own experience in your business and your lives, with the same type of things, varying only in degree and manner. Because it is true we have been through a revolution, and if I had to choose one word to describe the salient characteristic of the revolution of our times, the word would be collectivism. The tendency to center the power of all initiative in one central government, one central authority and its organs. And the weapon, the revolutionary agent that has brought this about, has been the tax machine. Certainly we willingly subscribe to a tax system based on taxing luxuries above necessities. By taxing the luxury, a man can choose whether he will pay the tax or not. And so we accept a tax on our motion picture tickets. And perhaps that's why we find 46% of the cost of a package of cigarettes is tax, and 31% of a bottle of beer, and 68% of a bottle of liquor. And certainly these are all luxuries we can do without. Perhaps we'd be better off for doing without them. But does it stop there? 34% of your phone bill is taxed, and 27% of your gas and oil, and more than 25% of the cost of your automobile. And the other day, the Hotel Association released the figures on hotels and what their tax problem is. In case you're inclined to protest when you receive your bill, the tax burden on American hotels today is $1.93 per day per room, whether that room is occupied or not. The income tax in our lifetime has grown from 31 words to a law of more than 440,000 words. No longer a tax system with regard to equitably raising consistently revenue needed by the government, but now a series of emergency levies exercised by one Congress after the other, laid one on top of the other until it has become a hodgepodge of conflict in which one man finds a loophole, another finds an inequity. And even the average man in the street has to employ legal help in computing his obligation to the government. Of course, in all fairness, I should point out that the government does have a simplified Form 1040 so that particularly the man of more modest income can fill out his income tax return without hiring a lawyer. Recently, they have had to put out a book of instructions as to how to fill out the simplified form. I was very interested in reading one sentence I would like to quote to you. This sentence appears on page 8 of the book of instructions on how to fill out the simple form. The one sentence is entitled Additional Charge for Underpayment of Estimated Tax. And it says, the charge with respect to any underpayment of any installment is mandatory and will be made unless the total amount of all payments of estimated tax made on or before the last date prescribed for the payment of such installment equals or exceeds whichever of the following is the lesser. The amount which would have been required to be paid on or before such date of the estimated tax were whichever of the following is the least. The tax shown on your return for the previous year, if your return for such year showed a liability for tax and covered a taxable year of 12 months, or a tax computed by using the previous year's income with the current year's rates and exemptions, or 70%, 66 2/3% in the case of farmers, of a tax computed by projecting to the end of the year the income received from the beginning of the year up to the beginning of the month of the installment payment, or an amount equal to 90% of the tax computed at the rates applicable to the taxable year on the basis of the actual taxable income for the months in the taxable year ending before the month in which the installment is required to be paid. There are 212 words in that sentence, and don't ask me to interpret it. I had a hell of a time reading it. And when finally the average citizen has waded through this entire hodgepodge in the 440,000 words of the law and has filled out his tax, the government does not give him a receipt marked paid in full, but says we reserve the right to come back several years from now and differ with you in our interpretation of the law, and you owe us an additional amount plus penalty. And when this happens to you, it'll be the only time in your legal experience as a citizen in which you are guilty and must prove your innocence. In the field of progressive surtax, it is entirely indefensible, particularly in the higher rates, except on an avowedly confiscatory theory. I doubt if there, for any length of time, any large-scale civilized community has ever labored under such a discrimination against incentive and initiative. Indeed, in its higher brackets, the progressive rate of personal income tax bears no relationship between the sacrifice exacted from the individual and the government's need for revenue. Year after year, it pushes us toward propertyless uniformity and collectivism. As a matter of fact, in the higher brackets, the surtax could be just canceled with no severe budgetary upset to the government. The total amount of tax collected from the first 2% of surtax up to the 91% level is only $5.5 billion. And above the 50% mark, it drops to $2.5 billion. And above 65%, the government gets less than $0.25 billion. This entire system of taxation was spawned more than 100 years ago by Karl Marx, who listed it as the prime essential of a socialist state. Indeed, Karl Marx said in Imposing Statism on a People, "You will find it necessary to use the progressive system of income tax to wipe the middle class and tax them out of existence." And today we find the steepest rate of increase in our surtaxes occurs through the middle income brackets. In our own free enterprise system, the tax reaches 34% at $8,000 of income, 43% at 12 and passes the 50% mark at $16,000. And through those brackets, you have listed most of the small businessmen in our land, most of our professional people, most of the key executives of large business, and the skilled craftsmen, the farmer, and the supervisory personnel. All of this has been foisted off on us on a theory of those best able to pay should pay in order that the small man least able to pay should not have to bear an unjust burden. It's been a sort of soak-the-rich measure. Well, has it been effective in that way? Has it spared the small man? The average family income in America today is $6,200 a year. Let's go way below that. Let's go to the man with a gross income of $3,500. He has a wife and two children. His gross income, $3,500, and when at the end of the year, he figures up the amount of tax he has paid local, state, and federal, including the many indirect taxes, $1,045 of his gross income will have gone to the tax collector. We have been told by economists down through the years that any time the tax burden in our country, the total tax burden, passes 25% of our income, we are in danger of losing our free enterprise system. Today, the total amount of tax collected in America equals 31 cents out of every dollar earned. And of the 31 cents, 23 cents goes to the federal government, leaving 8 cents for the state, the county, and the city to hire the teachers and the policemen and the firemen and build the sewers and the streets and perform all the services we require in our daily lives. In 1955, George Humphrey, then Secretary of the Treasury, told a committee of Congress that the rates were too high, and if they continued at the present level for any long period of time, our free enterprise system was in danger. A year ago in 1957, Colin Stamm, head of the Professional Tax Advisors to the Joint Tax Committee of the House and Senate, told that committee that if this country suddenly met an emergency, such as war, he did not know where we could raise a single additional billion of dollars in taxation without seriously jeopardizing our entire economy. And is the tax in our country used solely to raise revenue, or has it now begun to drift into the dangerous area of having a policing effect? Well, how many of us are aware today of the struggle going on between the advocates of the public ownership of power and the advocates of private ownership of utilities and power? There again, the advocates of public power have left the idea completely behind that public power was only to fill in that gap where it was economically impractical for private power to do the job. And today, with atomic power looming on the horizon in the future, the advocates of public power are openly demanding more and more public power and direct competition. And to do this, they, of course, are getting out literature pointing out how much cheaper their rates are than the private power rates. So a short time ago, when the private utility companies embarked on a program of institutional advertising, pointing out that the difference in government power rates and private power rates was occasioned by the fact that private power had to pay taxes,
The Bureau of Internal Revenue ruled just a few months ago that they could not deduct this advertising as a legitimate business expense for tax purposes. And if you think they're lonely, a short time ago, doctors in this country who banded themselves together to form an educational group to educate the people about the hazards and the dangers of the rising tide of socialized medicine were informed the same thing by the Bureau of Internal Revenue, and I'd like to read you just one line from the ruling of the Bureau. It said to these doctors, opposing socialization of the medical or other segment of the economy, or supporting the principles of individual liberty and freedom of individuals in the medical profession or elsewhere, are not, in our opinion, per se, educational functions or objectives, and you're not entitled to exemption of federal income tax. Some time ago, some of us went to Washington to appear before the House Ways and Means Committee to advocate the adoption of the Sadlack-Herlong tax proposals for reform. That's a bipartisan measure. Sadlack's a Republican, Herlong is a Democrat. If you don't know about it, I would recommend it to you very highly. It is the first program of tax reform advocated in this country in 35 years. It brings corporate and personal income tax ceilings down over a five-year period to a 42% ceiling and a base tax of 15%. It's been very well thought out. We appeared before the committee, but what was the most entertaining to us and the most enlightening was to appear before some of our congressmen off the record. And our congressman told us that he didn't think the bill would get any place, and he was prophetic and right. It didn't get any place. He said it won't get any place because it makes too much sense. He said it cuts across so many lines and benefits so many people so generally that Congress is not feeling any pressure from any particular group. And then he went on and told us some of the problems of a congressman. He said today our government, in its permanent structure, the bureaus and departments and agencies, has grown so big and so complex that we of Congress no longer can control it. We no longer know whether their functions are necessary or right, or whether they actually need the money they ask for. He said we have to take the word of the bureau and department heads when they come to us. And suddenly a lot of things became clear to us. When you think of this, you can then understand why a Congress can meet and appropriate $700 million for a reclamation project to take land out of the desert and reclaim it and put it into fruitful farm production, and a few hours later the same Congress can appropriate $1.5 billion in soil bank payments to take farmland out of production. You begin to understand why the Navy today is buying sunglasses by the thousands of pairs at $5 a pair, and the Air Force is selling the same sunglasses at $1.25 a pair as surplus. You understand why here in California one base could put up for sale at 10 cents on the dollar $140,000 worth of tires, not even unwrapped. And within 100 miles were two other military installations that had orders in at that moment for new tires of the same size and specifications. In Greenland, $250 million worth of spare parts for machinery is bulldozed into a snowbank and only comes to light when the same base sends in orders for more of the same kind of machinery. And down in the south, a farmer who never made over $400 a year in his life raising hogs is getting $1,000 a year now from the government for not raising hogs. And you ask, if he doesn't raise twice as much, will the government give him $2,000? And in Indiana and Michigan today are two farmers who have had their bank accounts and their machinery confiscated by the Department of Agriculture because they refuse to become a part of the allotment program, even though they are not going into the marketplace with one item that they are raising on their farm, that they are raising the grain for their own use on their own farm as livestock feed, and yet they have had their machinery confiscated, their bank accounts taken. You look at the Hoover Commission, appointed under two administrations, under Herbert Hoover, to investigate government and to find out where we could save money. And Herbert Hoover described the work of the committee as a fantastic nightmare of working in regimented chaos. He found this government of ours the largest single property owner in the world, owns 2.5 typewriters for every individual employed by government who uses a typewriter. There is no central inventory. He found that the government has office space owned outright, equivalent to 1,250 Empire State Buildings. And yet Congress appropriates $100 million for a third House office building in Washington. And one member of Congress, in opposing this, not only said it was unnecessary, but he pointed out that for every congressman who will occupy an office in that building, it represents a construction cost of $375,000. That should build a very large office for each individual indeed. Government is in business to the extent of more than 19,000 businesses in direct competition with private enterprise. The Defense Department is in 2,500 businesses covering 47 different lines of activity, including the ownership and operation of 150 ice cream factories. And in these businesses, government loses every year more than $30 billion, almost the total amount of money collected in the entire personal income tax in our land. A few years ago, Mr. C.E. Wilson, who had just finished being head of the War Production Board, went to government with a plan so startling, so simple, that you wonder how it could have been ignored. Mr. Wilson suggested that these government-owned industries, which are evaluated at about $28 billion, that these businesses, the government should organize stock companies and allow the American citizens to trade in their bonds for shares of stock in these government-owned plants. And he said, in this way, you would, in one fell swoop, wipe out 10% of the national debt by retiring $28 billion worth of bonds. You would cut $1 billion off the annual interest payment on the debt. You would eliminate a $30 billion loss that the government is undergoing each year, which we're making up out of our tax dollars. And like a chain reaction, it goes on, because you would add to the tax rolls $28 billion worth of businesses that are now not taxed, which would help share the tax burden with the rest of us. And the only comment Mr. Wilson received from government was, from the occupant of the White House at the time, he didn't think it was smart politically. Now we have been told that our next budget will be approximately $79 billion. And why? Well, again, we turned to our congressman in the off-the-record session, and our congressman told us, and here we come into our share of the blame. Our congressman said, what are we supposed to do? Every congressman in Washington today knows that he will not get reelected by saving money. He gets reelected by being able to go home and boast of how much federal spending he was able to secure for his home district. There are more than 1,000 lobbyists in Washington, D.C., representing groups of private American citizens. None of them are asking the government to save money. All are asking the government to spend money on some project. How many of us in this room who are veterans, how many of us know the things that are being lobbied in our behalf by our organizations? How many of us know that a bill is being ready to be presented to the next session of Congress that asks for a $100 a month pension for every World War I veteran at age 60, whether he needs it or not? How many of us realize that the medical program that is being asked in our behalf for non-service-connected disabilities for 23 million veterans in this country and their dependents is outright socialization of the medical profession? How much longer can we as veterans, representing more than one-third of the workforce of this nation, stand silently by and ask that the two men beside us at the workbench dig into their pockets and buy privileges and services for us that they cannot have for themselves? Today, there are less than 40,000 service-connected disabilities in the United States. 3 out of 4 of the beds occupied in Veterans Administration hospitals are occupied by non-service-connected disabilities. And the law says that when a veteran approaches a Veterans Administration hospital and asks for hospitalization, all he has to state is that he doesn't have the money to pay for this himself, and the Veterans Administration is prohibited by law from investigating his word or questioning him. They must accept his word at face value. And the AFL-CIO, of which I am a member, has announced that they are going before Congress and demand complete medical, hospital, and dental care for all people who are on Social Security today. The initial cost will be $6 billion a year, and the eventual cost by 1975, $25 billion a year. And no one asks where the free lunch will come from. How many of these advocates of pension funds and of health benefits from government, how many of them really are concerned with taking care of a need, or are simply advocating it because they believe in government doing all these things? Because has there been any recognition in the last 10 years of the increases in industrial pension funds, in union welfare programs, or in individual and commercial hospital and medical benefits or insurance for our citizens? How many of these people, in their demands for public aid, medical aid, have recognized that today more than 100 million Americans are covered by some form of medical or hospital insurance privately? In the last two decades, we've indulged in a great program of social progress, many welfare projects, and I'm sure that most of us, in spite of their cost, wouldn't buy back many of these projects at any price. They have represented forward thinking on our part. Certainly no thinking American would dispute the idea that there should be an economic floor beneath which no citizen of this land should be allowed to live. But isn't it about time that we did a little checking up on the architects who designed that floor to see if at the same time they are not designing an economic ceiling above which no American citizen in the future will be allowed to rise, regardless of his contribution to the national welfare, his initiative, and his personal ability? Have we not perhaps sought that great dream of every individual, security, by way of government, at the possible risk of putting wishbones where backbones should be? Certainly we have paid a price, because every government service must be paid for not only in cash, but in the loss of an individual freedom. And we have paid the price in a collective dictatorship of internal powers and bureaucratic institutions, against which today the individual citizen is absolutely helpless. And these institutions, this concentration of power under whatever ideology or whatever name you give it, is the very essence of totalitarianism. And what to do? Well, it would be nice if someone could advocate some magic formula, some single action that we could take that would solve the entire problem. It isn't that easy, and yet it's not too difficult. All we have to recognize is that we're still the most powerful group of individual citizens in the world today. All we have to do is realize that there is no vacuum in this relationship with our government, that either we run government as the founding fathers intended we should, or government runs us. So first of all, we must get mad. We must get mad at the man next to us who says there isn't anything we can do. And the next thing we must do is recognize that, as Burke said, for evil to triumph, it is only necessary that good men do nothing. We must have, first of all, the unselfish wisdom to not run to our congressmen when they threaten to close the government installation in our neighborhood and demand that it be kept open, whether it's needed or not. Indeed, we must be the first to go to Washington and say the government installation in our neighborhood is no longer necessary. Close it, regardless of whether it takes a payroll out of our particular local economy or not. We cannot ask for economy only in the other fellow's district. And then when the $79 billion budget is submitted, we must recognize the propaganda that will accompany it. Each time when we protest at the size of the budget, government says to us, okay, which program do you want to eliminate? And this, I state unequivocally, is dishonest propaganda on the part of government, because it is a bland assumption on the part of government that everything the government is doing is being done as efficiently and as economically as it can be done. We, in turn, start fighting among ourselves. Those who believe in foreign aid stand up and say, don't eliminate this. And those who believe in the farm program say, don't eliminate this. And finally, Congress smugly says, you see, no one really wants the budget cut at all. What we have to do is recognize what several congressmen of both parties told us in the last congressional session, in which they themselves had advocated $5.5 billion in budget cuts. And they said these cuts have not reached a single muscle fiber. They are still cuts in the area of useless fat. None of the cuts, of course, were put into effect. We must say, when government says to us that we can't cut taxes until we cut spending, we must recognize that this in itself is a lie, because no government in history has ever voluntarily reduced itself in size. Government does not tax to get the money it needs. Government will always find a need for the money it gets. And so, when they cite the need to defend ourselves, yes, we all agree with that. No American today would advocate toying with the need for defending the ramparts of our freedom from outside aggression. But there is another menace to our freedom. The menace is that we should lose those ramparts from within by default. Take the very creeping program of inflation, and we've all heard the word so much anymore that we pay no attention to it. It is true that inflation in its first stages is like getting drunk. There's a nice warm glow about it. That's before the hangover sets in. Well, I'm not going to talk about poor people now. Let's take a fellow that in 1939 was very successful and had an income of $50,000 a year. This is a wonderful goal to reach in this country. This is sort of up where you really begin to get in the rarefied atmosphere. But incidentally, from $50,000 on down, in the figures I'm about to give, the percentages are exactly proportionate. Today, to meet the creeping inflation we have known since 1939, a citizen would have to earn enough more money because of the shrinking value of the dollar. And when you couple this with the progressive rate of surtax, which is based not on the value of the dollar, but on the numbers of dollars earned, each time that he increases his purchasing power to equal what it was in 1939, he must then also move up into another bracket of income tax. And so today, the $50,000 a year man must earn $385,000 to have the same purchasing power he had in 1939. And by 1975, at the same rate and with the same continuing tax, he'll have to earn $844,000 to be the equivalent of a $50,000 a year man. And you can translate those same proportionate figures right on down to $2,000 a year. We have to point out to these advocates of big spending who appeal to our patriotism that the very source of our strength in this country is our individual freedom and our system of free competitive enterprise. And there can be no security any place in the free world if there is not economic and fiscal stability in the United States. We have just gone through the torchlight parades of the last election. We've waved the banners of the parties, our partisan choice. But let's be honest and look into our own hearts and minds. With regard to government economy and the reduction of size of government, have we not really been asked to choose between Tweedledum and Tweedledee? Today, there are more government employees in the United States than there are farmers in this entire land. It's about time that we started looking at those individuals of both parties who are speaking the old-fashioned philosophy that the least government is the best government. Now, if it's too complex for Congress to solve, if they can't keep track of the bureaus and departments, it's too complex for us. That's true. But when you're faced with a Gordian knot, you don't try to unravel it. You cut it. And there is only one way that we can control this. We must stop fighting among ourselves on the various issues that are placed before us. And we must recognize we have only one issue. In cutting that Gordian knot, we must say to government, here is the debt ceiling, no more deficit spending, and here is the amount of money we are going to give you next year, and you must keep your house within this amount of money. In short, we must cut off the fodder upon which government has fed and grown beyond the consent of the governed. In all of mankind's history, he has known but a few moments of freedom, and most of those moments have been ours here in this blessed land. This is indeed the last best hope today of man on earth. And we're late in the afternoon of the day of decision. We've been profligate with our yesterdays. We've waited too long today. But if any of us here are short-sighted enough to believe that there can possibly be a tomorrow, that if we cannot take up the cudgel and fight back until the fight has actually reached our doorstep, that it's somebody else's fight, then we're about as short-sighted as a fellow going into the poultry business without a rooster. We're putting a hell of a lot of confidence in the stork. Thank you.